Session number 19817, Reel 4.
Terence Molloy, Reel 4.
The battalion remained in the Yew River area until mid-March, when it had to fall back to Moray in the Cabourg Valley, because the Japanese had then started their assault on Imphal. I myself had left the battalion about 3 weeks before, as I had been sent back to the other side of India with a group of three other officers to be attached to Royal Marine Commandos who were training in the Western Ghats, now in the Belgaum area. On the way back, I developed malaria, and literally on the road back, I had to be taken off the jeep in which I was riding and put into the casualty clearing hospital, which was high up on the hills around Shenam, scene of later battles in 1944. This must have been the forwardmost hospital in which there were nursing sisters at that time. I spent a week there recovering from malaria, and then carried on and ended up in Calcutta and met up with these other officers. And after a further delay at Calcutta, which was in pretty good turmoil from the point of view of transportation at that time, we managed to get a train across India to Belgaum and joined the 42 Royal Marine Commando doing their training. Almost as soon as I got there, within a week I should say, it was obvious that the Japanese invasion of Manipur had taken place, and that my battalion must be in the thick of it. And I felt determined, if I could, to get back to them. And there I was training these Royal Marine Commandos who'd already been in Norway, Madagascar, one or two other places, knew far more about active service than we could teach them. So I formed up to the CO of the unit and said to them, I really must try and get back to the battalion. And he said, well, if I was you, I'd feel the same. So one of our group was a doctor. And I said, well, you go back to Belgaum and send a telegram to the CO recalling us. And he concocted this telegram and said that we were to recall to our units. And the CO sent us, when he got the telegram, said, right, off you go. And we went back and reported to the area headquarters, said, here we are, we've been recalled, we'd like some rail tickets back to Calcutta, please. And they were a bit horrified. In fact, they should really have stopped us. But I think they were taken off guard and provided us with the rail warrants, and we went back to Calcutta. Having got to Calcutta, I had my Batman with me, incidentally, all through this. Calcutta was in complete chaos and turmoil because of the threat of the Japanese, who are now obviously threatening India. And it was very difficult to get any sense out of anybody. So I went to the railway station, the one that leads into Bengal, Sialdah, I think it's called, Calcutta Railway Station, and said, I want a ticket on the some sort of train up to Silchar in Assam. I chose that because I had a friend who was a tea planter, and he'd been based at Silchar, and I thought perhaps I could contact him and leave my kit with him. Well, there wasn't a hope of getting a ticket, so eventually I went up to the booking office and rustled a 100 rupee note at the clerk, and he produced the necessary tickets there and then, and got on the train, and off we went up to Assam. On arrival at Silchar, I went to the Silchar Club, and the secretary said, indeed I know your friend, but I'm afraid he's been posted away elsewhere. And I said, well, I am in a jam, I've got nowhere to stay, and I've got this kit with me. And he said, and I want to get into Burma. And he said, well, the only thing I can suggest is if you go out to the airfield, there's a mail plane that lands there every day and flies on into Imphal. So he said, you can leave your kit with me and I'll look after it. So early the next morning, my batman and I got on a jeep and drove out to the airfield, a little airstrip it was really. And sure enough, this Dakota landed there, driven by an American, and dropped off the mail and was heading off back onto Imphal. And I said, well, can you take us into Imphal? And he said, yeah, I can only take one. So I had to leave my batman behind. I had to decide then and there. And I regret to say I never saw him again. I hope he was all right. But I got on the plane and got it back into Imphal and rejoined my battalion, who were then had withdrawn from the Kabul Valley and were in a place called Wanjing in reserve. Actually, they were out on a penetration patrol, I think you might call it, which they had been sent out to try and cut the Japanese LFC when I got there, but the rear echelons of the battalion were there, and I joined up with them and waited the return of the battalion, which came the next day. By then, the Japanese were advancing on Imphal from all sides, and our brigade, that's the 32nd Indian Infantry Brigade, commanded by Brigadier Mackenzie, was ordered to join 17th Indian Division, who were retreating up from Tidim and were to act as a rear guard for them. Brigadier decided to go on a reconnaissance down the Tidim Road, and he asked for officers of the battalion to accompany him, and I was one of them, and rode down the road with him. We got down about as far as milestone 33, I think it was, or something like that, south of Imphal, when we encountered the Indian Brigade, which was holding a position astride the road, awaiting the withdrawal of 17 Div. Well, this position that they'd occupied was just a nullah, really, lying astride the road running south. There were bare paddy fields on either side, no particular cover, And rising up on the west side were this huge range of hills bordering the Imphal Plain. Well, the brigadier took one look at this position and felt it was so easily bypassed, it had no particular merit at all that he could see. So he decided to withdraw back 17 miles to Bishanpur, which was a small township on the road about milestone 16 from south of Imphal, at a point where the hills on the west came very close to the road, and there was some possibility of a good position being built there. So he signalled back to division headquarters and said, could he have permission to occupy this position, which was meant a withdrawal of 17 miles, and they agreed to it. So the battalion moved into position at Bishanpur. We were told that we would be there for as long as we could hold it, and we were to dig as formidable a position as we could. So we set to with a will, and I must say we destroyed half a village and got all the timber from the village and built enormously strong bunkers and overhead cover and all the rest of it for ourselves, and really went to town and built a strong position. This took us about 3 days, at the end of which we, quite honestly, pretty fagged out. And then in the middle of the night we were sent for, and the officer was sent for, and the CO said, right, you've got to go up and occupy the top of the hill on that ridge over there. And that was the following morning. One company was sent on ahead, and we were to follow in the afternoon. This was the Silchar track, which we had to go up. It was a jeep track, jeepable in dry weather, the map said, and that about summed it up. It was a mountain track, and just wide enough for a jeep to get along. And it was the valley on either side was full of jungle, but the actual track, most of the track, was very exposed on the hillside, and there were patches of jungle here and there, and the hills above were, again, some of them are completely open and grassy, and others of them were covered in either sparse jungle or very thick patches of bamboo jungle through which it was very difficult to penetrate. And our objective was this point 5846, which was the highest point above the Silchar track. The company which had led the way, gone on ahead, they'd gone up to a hill on the other side of the track, further to the south, on the ridge, to try and make contact with the Japanese, who were known to be advancing. And in fact, the Japanese leading platoon came up against this company, and a battle ensued. And the Japanese were beaten back. In the meantime, we'd come up the track in the heat of the afternoon. It must have been about 19 in the shade, I suppose. It was very hot. And we were very tired after all our defensive work. However, we walked up this track carrying all our stuff with us. And then on up to the 5846, that total climb was about 3,000 feet, I suppose, up the hill. And, of course, I'd been away from the company for nearly 2 months, I suppose, and the The men had changed. There had been a new draft in. I didn't know the NCOs, and they were a new lot altogether.
Were you a company commander?
Still company commander, yes.
Of two company?
Of two company. And so I thought that they were as well trained as they had been. But of course, it wasn't so. And when we got up to the top of the hill, I said, now we must dig in, get cracking, dig in. And lo and behold, the picks and shovels, which the men had been given to carry, had become too heavy for them, and they discarded them as they went up the hill. So when we arrived at the top, there was hardly a pick and shovel left to dig in with. So we felt we spent a very uncomfortable night on the top of this hill in a scrubby patch of jungle, completely exposed to any fire that might have been brought to bear on us. But luckily none was. And the next day the more picks and shovels were brought up by mule transport, and we were able to dig in as far as we could. We were then on the very peak of this hill, and it was mostly a very thick bamboo jungle which you couldn't see through more than a few yards, and very difficult to get through at all except along little animal tracks or other little open spaces there might be. And the battalion, less the one company which was already engaged with Japanese, were in a defensive position up there. But we didn't get much of a respite, because the the next night the Japanese attacked us, and my company was on one side and was not directly attacked, but the other company, number four company, was heavily attacked and managed to beat off attacks in the night. This was my company merely got shelled with grenade by grenade launchers, which were really like small mortars. And the Japanese had a big advantage over us, because these grenade launchers were able to fire a projectile which did not go off when it hit the trees. It had a time fuse, so they dropped down through the trees and then went off. Whereas our 2-inch mortar had a percussion head on the bomb, which went off when it hit the trees. The other thing was that their grenade launcher was able to fire at very close range, about 100 yards or less, whereas our 2-inch mortar, you couldn't bring it down to less than 200 yards, which in close combat in the jungle was of no particular use. We tried to depress the barrel so you were firing it more or less horizontally, but that wasn't easy. But every time it hit a tree, it was likely to burn, you know, the bomb went off, so it had little value. The night before this final attack came in, we were all patrolling as far as we could to make sure the area was... We got to know the area, and there were no Japanese about. And I'd sent out one patrol with an officer, and the patrol came back, and I said, where's the officer? And they said, oh, he's wounded. So I said, well, can you take me to show me where he is? And luckily there was a corporal who'd come from the Warwick Regiment, I think, who seemed to know what he was doing. And he said, yes, I can take you back. So I got together some more men, together with a stretcher party, and we set off The corporal leading the way, show the way. And here again I was dismayed at the lack of standard of training of the men, particularly the stretcher bearers, who had to have four of them with a stretcher, and they were walking along happily discussing the relative merits of their different favourite football teams, without any idea that we were liable to be ambushed by the enemy at any moment. So I had to stop everybody and gesticulate and whisper and generally make a show of myself to try and impress upon them what we were trying to do. And I must have seemed to them like a maniac, I think, the way I was going on. But I was, quite honestly, pretty terrified of them rather than anything else. Anyway, we went on and eventually got to where this officer was. He was propped up against a tree in this thick bamboo jungle. And he'd thrown a grenade which had killed a Japanese and also wounded him in the knee, so he couldn't walk. So I saw that he'd have to be put on the stretcher to be taken away. And he was a little way up the hill in the thick bamboo, and it was all very slippery and slidey, of course. And not far up the hill, couldn't have been more than, or less than 50 yards, less than that, I could hear the Japanese digging and talking. And I thought, oh Lord, you know. So we must try and get this chap out as quickly and quietly as we can. So it took quite a job to get him onto the stretcher and get the stretcher down this slope and onto the comparatively level path we'd come along. This we managed to do without any interference with the enemy, by the enemy, and managed to get him back.
Was he from the Warwicks?
Sorry?
Was he from the Warwicks?
The officer? No, he was, I don't know where he'd come from. He joined us in somewhere in Imphal, I think, or somewhere. He hadn't been long with us. And managed to get him back, and he was evacuated. But, as I say, that night the enemy attack came in, and the bombardment with the grenade launchers and things. And I thought I'd made quite a good little position for myself with my two signalers. It hadn't any overhead cover, unfortunately, because there wasn't anything to make any overhead cover with. But we dug quite a good trench, and I thought we were pretty well off. But these grenade launchers came over and landed right in the trench where I was with the two signalers, and they were both killed. And I didn't know they were killed, but I knew they'd been hit. So I said, hang on, I'll go and get a stretcher bearer. So I was scrambling out of the trench to go to the RAP, the aid post, and just then another grenade launcher came down, and this time hit me in the foot. So I was out of action too. There really wasn't much use after that, and told everyone to stay where they were for the night, and nothing else we could do really. And I spent the night in the RAP, and the following morning I was evacuated. The first thing that happened was that I was put on a stretcher at battalion headquarters. It was daytime then, quite light, and the RSM came up and said, Can I have your rifle, sir? You won't need that anymore. And I said, I suppose you must. They took my rifle from me. I sat on this stretcher, and there was one or two more wounded on stretchers, and we set off like a cortege, and the stretchers were bearers were Indians of some unknown tribe. I don't know who they were. They looked like Japanese. They had rather shaggy hair and mongoloid features, and they could well have been Japanese, but who they were, I don't know. I couldn't communicate with them anyway. So we set off, and it was about 1,000 feet down the hill to the ADS, the Advanced Dressing Station. And it was a lovely day, a lovely morning. I remember sitting up on my stretcher like an Indian potentate being carried down the hillside. And the path went down this grassy hillside and open on one side, and on the other side there was this thick bamboo jungle. And I thought to myself, well, if anything's lurking in that thick bamboo jungle, nothing I can do about it. I had my rifle taken away from me. I'm sitting up on this stretcher like a sitting duck. So anyway, I had to go on down. And we got about halfway down, and one of the poles of the stretcher broke. I came down onto the ground. And however, the stretcher bearers, quite resourceful, they went into the jungle and produced another pole and fixed it up. And on we went down. I reached the advanced dressing station with no trouble at all. And there I was seen by a RAMC doctor. And he had a look at my wound, and he said, "You've been very lucky. It hasn't broken your ankle bone. It's just skim the side of it, and you should be all right." So he wrapped me up again, and then I was put on a jeep ambulance, which carried four stretcher cases, and driven down the hill to Bishancourt, also without incident. At Bishancourt, I was put on an ambulance, motor ambulance, driven by the American Field Service, a Quaker organization which had these volunteers who came and joined us and drove ambulances for us. Extremely gallant they were too, because they carried on right through the campaign under fire and on in many occasions with their ambulances shot through and through. The only sour note in my evacuation up to then was the fact that we used to take off our boots at night and put on our plimsolls or rubber-soled shoes so that we could make no noise as we went around the position. And my boots had been put in the jeep ambulance together with my pack and so on. And when I got to the other ambulance, the boots disappeared. And I'm afraid to say it must have been the some members of the Royal Army Medical Corps who decided that they were a nice pair of boots, which they like. I was particularly upset because they were a pair of boots which my father had sent me from home. Anyway, I wasn't able to get a boot on for nearly 2 years, so it probably didn't matter.